The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
You know, if you're arguing the second case of the day, there's a backup counsel table that's just behind the arguing counsel's table. And so it's actually one of the best seats in the house. And actually, I was really, really glad that I was able to, have an hour, basically, after the pomp and circumstance of the court coming into session, the justices ascending the bench, to just sort of, you know, collect my thoughts, to watch other people argue, and to settle into the moment. I think it would have been a lot more stressful for me if I had been first. And it was really fun to sit there. I mean, the first case was this hyper-technical civil procedure case where my, you know, former mentor Neil Katyal was arguing on behalf of the respondents. And it was just a lot of fun to see Neil in action and to sort of rev myself up for what I was about to do. Basically, like, you know, look, they get questions they're not sure of the answer of either, right? And the justices, you know, they're human. They're smiling. They're having a good time. Like, this is not as intimidating as it might feel like at first blush.
Hello, I'm Scott Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for January 27th, 2018. This week, I interviewed longtime Lawfare contributor and University of Texas law professor Steve Laddick about his recent experience arguing before the United States Supreme Court in Dalmasi v. United States. Dalmasi is a unique case that may have implications not only for the military commissions and our military justice system, but for how the Supreme Court itself operates. Fair warning, listeners, this one gets a bit into the legal weeds. This is the Lawfare Podcast, episode 279, Steve Laddick on Dalmasi and the Supreme Court.
Let's just start at the beginning of this case. Who is Dalmasi and the other petitioners in the case, and how did you get involved with them?
Sure. So Nicole Dalmasi is a second lieutenant, or at least was a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, who was court-martialed for wrongfully using a controlled substance, to wit, ecstasy, and was basically ordered to be dismissed from the Air Force. She appealed her conviction to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Each service branch has one of these CCAs, basically an appeals court for that service branch. And one of the judges who heard her appeal was a judge, Colonel Martin Mitchell, who at the time he heard Dalmasi's appeal was also serving as a judge on the Court of Military Commission Review, the CMCR, this intermediate appeals court Congress created to sit between the military commissions at Guantanamo and the D.C. Circuit. And so Dalmasi basically argued that Judge Mitchell was no longer eligible to hear her appeal to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals because his appointment to the Court of Military Commission Review had triggered this old statute, 10 U.S.C. Section 973B, which we like to shorthand as the dual office holding ban, a violation of which should have required his forfeiture of his military commission and therefore of his ability to continue to serve on the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Dalmasi is one of 8 service members whose cases were consolidated in the Supreme Court. There are actually 170 additional service members whose similar claims, are pending in 4 additional petitions that the court is sitting on. So there are 178 court-martial defendants, and then there's also folks in the military commissions themselves, 2 of the 9/11 defendants, who have raised a similar objection to the CMCR directly. So a lot of cases, a lot of pending proceedings, all raising the same basic challenge.
So before we go further on the substance, I want to take one step back and talk a little bit more about your role in all of this. Now, you're obviously not a military lawyer, at least that I'm not aware of. And judging from your number of oral arguments, you're not a frequent advocate in these sorts of forums. How did you get involved with this set of petitioners and with this matter as a whole personally and as an advocate?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been, you know, sort of involved in one way or another with the military commissions pretty much from their inception in 2002. I was part of the legal team in the Hamdan case through which I got to meet a whole bunch of military lawyers, including, as will become relevant to this story, then Lieutenant Commander Brian Meiser. And I was obviously, you know, closely following all of the challenges to the CMCR in the D.C. Circuit, including the Nashiri case that we've talked about. It just so happened that Brian Meiser, who had been, you know, intimately involved in these cases when he was a Navy JAG lawyer, in his civilian life is actually now one of the chief defense counsels of the Air Force, of the Air Force Appellate Division.
Interesting.
And so Brian actually had both Dalmazi and the sort of case right behind it, Ortiz, as cases that were on his docket. And so after the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces ruled in Dalmazi in December of 2016, Brian reached out to me and said, "Hey, you know, I have you been following these cases? If you have, would you have an interest in helping us take them up to the Supreme Court?" And I actually had been following them, and I was, you know, excited at the prospect and the opportunity. You know, I harbored no illusion that we had a really good chance of getting the Supreme Court to take the cases, but it seemed like a worthwhile endeavor and a really fun project tied to the dual office holding ban.
Interesting. And so give us some background on the CMCR, the Court of Military Commission Review. What role does this institution play, and why are there judges serving on both it and these courts of appeal?
Sure. I mean, so Congress created the CMCR in 2006, I think at least in part because Congress thought it was modeling the court-martial system. Congress thought it was modeling the military commission system that it was enacting in response to the Supreme Court's Hamdan decision, at least to some degree, on the court-martial system. And so the CMCR was at least initially, I think, designed and intended to play a very similar role to the courts of criminal appeals in the court-martial system. They had similar jurisdiction. The judges were meant to be chosen the same way. And so I think it was logical, at least through that lens, to think about borrowing the judges, that if the judges were good enough for the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, we can just borrow them for the CMCR as well. I think what got missed here by Congress, both in 2006 when they first enacted the statute, in 2009 when they tried to fix it, is that there was one critical difference all along between the CMCR and the CCAs, and that is who was supervising them. So the CCAs are subject to appellate review by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, or CAF, which is located in the executive branch. And that's why in 1997, the Supreme Court held in a case called Edmund versus United States that CCA judges are inferior executive branch officers, which, among other things, means that they can be assigned to the CCAs without requiring a new appointment. The CMCR, although it was modeled on the CCAs, it is not subject to appellate review by another court that's in the executive branch. Instead, it's subject to appellate review quite intentionally by the Article III D.C. Circuit, which leads to, I think, the very serious and, in my view, ultimately correct argument that CMCR judges, unlike CCA judges, are principal officers, and that they therefore have to be appointed separately to the CMCR by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. This argument was pressed in the military commissions by Al Nashiri, who's being tried for, among other things, his alleged involvement in the bombings of the USS Cole. And what the D.C. Circuit held in a mandamus petition in Nashiri's case in 2015 is that this was actually a pretty serious argument. Nashiri couldn't quite make out the high bar for mandamus relief, but Judge Henderson's opinion for the court went out of its way to encourage President Obama to take the then assigned military officer judges on the CMCR and to formally appoint them to the CMCR in order to make that appointments clause problem go away. President Obama did that, and President Obama nominated, the Senate confirmed, 5 military officer judges to also sit on the CMCR. The problem is that's the point where we have to start talking about the dual office holding ban, because that's the moment at which, you know, these officers now held a second office that was arguably within the ambit of this, you know, Civil War era dual office holding statute.
And Colonel Mitchell, who oversaw the case of Ms. Dalmazzi, is presumably one of these five appointees.
That's right. There are five appointees, although only four ended up really mattering in the Supreme Court, because one of the judges basically stepped off the Navy Marine Corps CCA before any of these cases could really bubble up. So Colonel Mitchell is the one Air Force judge, and then there are three Army judges, Judge Paulette Burton, Judge Lance Seltniks, and Judge Herring, right? And so you have these all these cases sort of bubbling up through the Army and the Air Force Courts of Criminal Appeals, and the idea was to try to get the Supreme Court to look at them and to figure out, you know, what's the right answer here.
And this dual office holding ban, give us a little more background on that. You know, it certainly is a familiar concept, I think, to many of us. We think about civilian control of the military, the Secretary of Defense generally being, having to be a civilian. And many people, I think, recall when General Mattis was appointed, the requirement that he pursued special authorization from Congress for that. Is this related to that? Is this a similar, or is it a wholly separate set of rules?
No, it's definitely related. I mean, I think the dual office holding ban is in some ways the sort of the father of the Mattis specific problem. So the dual office holding ban dates to 1870, and Congress enacted it in the aftermath of the Civil War, at a time when the civilian executive branch was relatively small and the federal military was actually quite large, and Congress was concerned that there would be obvious pressure and incentive and motivation for military officers to find ways to insinuate themselves into all kinds of civilian positions, whether notorious ones like cabinet secretaries or purely minor ones like, at the time, there was a real controversy over Indian agents and military officers double-dipping and actually, you know, taking advantage of very corrupt practices. So Congress said, no, we're not going to allow this without some kind of clear authorization, really much along the lines of, I think, the somewhat more familiar Posse Comitatus Act, which was enacted 8 years after the dual office holding ban, and which, you know, is still on the books today as a prohibition against the domestic use of the military for civilian law enforcement without clear congressional authorization. So the dual office holding ban is why, for example, the Attorney General cannot be a general. It's why the Secretary of the Treasury can't be a general. Now, the Secretary of Defense is different because Congress, when it created that position in 1947, wanted to add an extra layer and not just require that the Secretary of Defense be a civilian, but require that he or she have been retired from the military for 7 years. That's what they had to waive when it came to Secretary Mattis. Otherwise, of course, the dual office holding ban is the general statute. It's why John Kelly, for example, had to retire before he could become Secretary of Homeland Security. The only sort of prominent federal positions that aren't covered by the dual office holding ban are those that don't require nomination by the president, confirmation by the Senate. So this is why H.R. McMaster, for example, can be National Security Advisor without running afoul of the dual office holding ban, or those very few positions where Congress has expressly authorized a military officer to dual hat. And the best examples of those are, I think, CIA and NSA directors, who both can be, and at least in the case of the NSA director, always is, a uniformed military officer.
My understanding, this leads us nicely into at least my understanding of what the government's position in this, or at least their objection to your argument. Essentially, my understanding is that they argue that first CMCR judges aren't really filling a kind of civil office within the scope of this rule. And then also that there was congressional authorization for appointing them to fill this role in the CMCR as military officers in the form of the assignment provision you mentioned before, the fact that these officers could be assigned to fulfill this sort of function. Am I reading that correctly in terms of the government position, and how did you all respond to that?
So, I mean, the government's position actually has two layers to it. You've hit the first layer, which is both that they don't think this is the CMCR judges hold a qualifying civil office, and even if they do, Congress authorized it. And I think, you know, our response, I think, is best, I think, organized around the basic principle that the Constitution and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence draw a bright line between positions that require an appointment and those to which officers can be assigned. And the government, I think, tries to blur this distinction. So when Congress in 2009 created a separate office for appointed CMCR judges, that's the position we're talking about. Now, we'll get into whether that's a civil office in a second. But so with regard to whether Congress authorized military officers to hold that office. Congress authorized military officers to be assigned to the CMCR, but of course, as we discussed, that raised its own constitutional problems. There's nothing in the relevant statute that authorizes military officers to be appointed to the CMCR. So if you agree with me that there's a meaningful doctrinal and constitutional difference between being assigned to exercise the duties of a second position, but still only holding one office, and actually formally holding both offices, I think the government's statutory authorization argument falls apart. On the civil office point, you know, the government makes a really big deal out of the notion that the CMCR is exercising what it calls a classic military function. And this is actually what the CMCR itself held in Nashiri in rejecting this challenge. And I think there are two problems with that. First, it's never been the case that the function of an office has been relevant to whether it's a civil office. So, for example, one of the really early important interpretations of the dual office holding ban was by the Attorney General in 1873, who concluded that the Secretary of War, which I think of as like a quintessentially military function, was nevertheless a civil office, and therefore could not an active duty officer could not even serve as acting Secretary of War without congressional authorization. So the function really hasn't been relevant historically to whether it's a civil office. The real question is, can a civilian hold it? And obviously, CMCR judges can be, and two of them are, civilians. But even if we actually cared deeply about the function, I don't know why it's so clear that appellate review of a military commission is a classic military function. There was never appellate review of military commissions in the United States until 2005. And even the judicial review that existed of military commissions going all the way back to, you know, the Civil War, World War II, et cetera, was usually collateral review conducted by civilian judges via habeas corpus. So I just, you know, I think it's not obvious why the function of the CMCR should matter at all, and even if it does, why it's so clear that that kind of appellate review is in fact a military as opposed to a typically civilian function.
You know, you all came into this side of arguments with a pretty aggressive request for a remedy. And I know it came up in oral argument that at least one of the justices found it to be pretty severe. What was the remedy that you all were pursuing?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, we argued that under the dual office holding ban, and let me be clear, I mean, the government at least agrees with part of our argument. So at least until 1983, the settled textual remedy for a violation of the dual office holding ban was the immediate vacatur of your military office. And this was a reflection of what's known as the common law doctrine of incompatibility, pursuant to which the acceptance of a second incompatible office ipso facto vacates your holding of the first office. It may seem weird, but if you guys think about, like, you know, the sort of last in time rule when it comes to statutory interpretation, it's actually sort of a cousin of that, right? That the later act supersedes the former one. What that would mean in practice in this case is that at the moment these military officers began to exercise the function of appointed judges on the Court of Military Commission Review, they ipso facto vacated their military commissions and ceased to be military officers. The government has a response, which is that there's language in amendments to the dual office holding ban in 1983 that could be read to mitigate that remedy, and that even if that's the right remedy, it's not available, you know, it's not, my clients were not the right people to seek it. And Justice Ginsburg, I think, picked up on this in the argument. She said, you know, isn't that a little bit draconian and unfair? And I guess our response to that is, yeah, but if the problem is, you know, we feel bad for the four officers in question, you know, there are lots of ways to make them whole. Congress can restore them to their prior position. Congress can restore any benefits or pensions that they might otherwise have lost or forfeited. And there's even actually an old Supreme Court case called Badeau versus United States that says the federal government's not allowed to proceed against a military officer who's been found to have vacated his commission for back pay, as long as the military officer was acting in good faith. So, you know, it certainly is a harsh consequence, but we think it's the one that the law mandates, because otherwise, how would you enforce a statute like this? How would you ensure that the dual office holding ban actually had any teeth?
That's an interesting question. That leads me into my next question. I mean, what other, you mentioned a few of these other remedies that might be available. Did the government put forward any alternative remedies in the event that it lost?
No. I mean, I think one of the reasons why we were successful, at least in getting the Supreme Court's attention and perhaps in getting them to take these cases, is because the government actually never took a particularly clear position on what exactly the remedy would be if we were right on the merits. Right, that is to say, if we were right that these four military officers had violated the dual office holding ban, the government never actually said what they thought should happen. That is to say, should they therefore get kicked off the CMCR, or should they therefore have been kicked out of the military, or is the answer just, oh well, you know, stuff happens, life goes on. And, you know, I was a bit surprised that none of the justices pushed the government on this at the oral argument, but I actually think it's one of the biggest holes in the government's position, which is on their view, it's not clear what the actual remedy is, even if we all agree that a particular act was in violation of the dual office holding ban.
Now, during the period where you all are working on your briefing, you know, cert's been granted, there was another submission from a third party in this case, a pretty exceptional submission in a lot of regards. This is from Aditya Bamzai, another law professor like yourself at the University of Virginia. And he came in with a kind of fundamental point, a position that was objected to both by yourself and your clients as well as the government, arguing that the U.S. Supreme Court fundamentally lacked the jurisdiction necessary to even hear this case. Can you walk us through his argument a bit?
Sure. I mean, this actually isn't the first time Aditya has made this argument. He and I both filed a couple years ago in a case called Akbar at the cert stage, where I was trying to convince the Supreme Court to grant this pretty important case out of the military justice system, and Aditya filed an amicus brief saying the Supreme Court didn't have the power to hear the case at all. So, you know, this was actually, Dalmazi is the first time the Supreme Court has heard a case from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces since 2009. It's the first time they've heard a case where it was the service member who sought review since 1997. So it was the first time for this theory to really get tested. And what Aditya's theory, I think, basically boils down to is, you know, we mentioned before that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, or CAF, is located in the executive branch for administrative purposes. And so Aditya's argument is that when the Supreme Court issues a writ of certiorari to review the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, it's actually issuing a writ directly to the executive branch, and it's therefore doing what is basically an original judicial proceeding in violation of Marbury versus Madison, which holds quite famously that the Supreme Court, that Congress cannot expand the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction, that the Supreme Court can only hear as an original matter the two classes of cases set out in Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2, that is to say, cases affecting ambassadors and those in which a state is a party. The theory depends upon accepting one of two propositions. Either that any entity that's in the executive branch cannot be a court, and so it doesn't matter if it looks like a court, smells like a court, if Congress, as it has with the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, calls it a court, it's still the executive branch and therefore Marbury applies, or basically that, you know, in fact, in reality, CAF is not a court. I don't know that either of those theories is going to hold a whole lot of weight with the Supreme Court, but I do think, and I think the argument revealed this, that the justices are not sure where to draw the line between, you know, proceedings that are clearly judicial and therefore properly invoke the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction and proceedings that are better characterized as administrative and therefore could not be directly reviewed by the Supreme Court. I think it's clear the court does not want the answer to be that Congress could give it direct authority over the Board of Immigration Appeals or the National Labor Relations Board or the Securities and Exchange Commission. I think it's equally clear that they're not willing to say that no non-Article III federal court is beyond their appellate review, because that would take with it, for example, the D.C. Court of Appeals. And the question is, where between those two propositions is there a clear line that puts, you know, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces on one side versus the other?
Now, my recollection is that you all really didn't respond directly to Professor Bumsey's argument in your briefing, although I know it came up a bit at oral argument. Do you have a theory? What is your view on the right place to draw the line on that spectrum as you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, we did, you know, we I mean, the government, which went first, in its briefing at least, you know, spent six pages on the amicus brief, and we largely agreed with its analysis. So we, you know, in our reply brief, I think we had like a sort of a two-thirds of a page long footnote where we basically agreed with the government. I think it's important to stress what the court doesn't have to decide here. I mean, I think it's pretty clear, regardless of where the line is, that what the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces does is quintessentially judicial. Congress has called it a court of record. That's not a term Congress bandies about and applies to things that aren't courts of record. This is adversarial judicial review of criminal convictions that in at least some cases, albeit none of mine, could include capital sentences. And so I think, you know, the line we proposed, I think more clearly in the oral argument, is that, you know, the court could simply hold that when Congress, you know, identifies a particular tribunal as a court of record, and there's no reason to think that Congress is incorrectly labeling that body, at least in those cases, the Supreme Court may constitutionally exercise appellate jurisdiction. And in fact, I actually think that, like, that's consistent with this 1894 Supreme Court case called United States versus Coe, where the Supreme Court unanimously upheld its power to review the then Article I Court of Public Land Claims, or I think it's Court of Private Land Claims, whatever, the Court of Land Claims. and it went out of its way to say, you know, it. I mean, in the words of Chief Justice Fuller, it follows, he said, that when Congress has the power to create some non-Article III lower federal court, that it has the power to give the Supreme Court the power to review it. I think that's enough to decide this case. Save for another day, what would happen in a situation where the direct review was of a body that was not a court of record and that did not, you know, reflect all the hallmarks that we would think of as a quintessentially judicial proceeding?
And if Professor Bomzai's argument were to prevail, what would that mean for the broader relationship between the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the CAF Court, and particularly in regards to matters outside of Dalmazi to previously decided matters, although it doesn't sound like there's a large volume of cases going to Supreme Court on appeal from CAF, what would the broader consequences be?
I think the consequences would be quite dramatic. I mean, I think there would be a lot of pressure on Congress to fix it right away. For example, for, you know, Congress to perhaps put CAF under the D.C. Circuit, much like the Court of Military Commission Review already is. Not sure how the D.C. Circuit would feel about that, but it would certainly solve the problem that Professor Bomzai has, you know, purported to identify. I think, you know, until and unless that happens, you'd have a real problem because you'd have all of these federal cases, including capital cases, including cases with serious constitutional questions, that the Supreme Court was powerless to review. And that's never really happened in our history. And so, you know, I'd be very surprised, not if the theory doesn't get at least a couple of votes. I think it's quite possible we'll see, you know, a concurring opinion that tries to sort of express support for this theory. But I'd be very surprised if the court really wanted to go there. I just don't see what the problem is. Like, it's not obvious to me that you couldn't draw the line between CAF and all the administrative agencies that the justices seemed worried about at the oral argument. And as Justice Kagan, I think, pointed out quite powerfully in her exchange with Aditya, these are cases. I mean, these are clearly the stuff Article III is talking about when it talks about cases or controversies. So I'm not surprised that the court took Adichie's argument seriously, that they gave him argument time, you know, that they sort of, you know, are looking so closely at this problem. But I think the reason why they're looking so closely is because they're worried about the next case, not this one. And so it's really just about how they can use this case to draw the line. I'm actually rather confident that they'll put CAF on the right side of whatever that line is.
So at this stage in kind of the proceedings, you all have your briefings and you have your arguments laid out and you're approaching oral argument. At what point did you all make the decision that you were going to be the oral advocate for this case, coming in as a first-timer, if you will, at the court? And how far out did you know? You know, did you go into the briefing knowing you were going to be the person making these arguments, or is that a decision that's made later in the game?
I mean, every case is different. In our case, we had actually, I think, agreed from the beginning that I would be the lead counsel and that if the court, you know, saw fit to grant certiorari, that I'd be the one to argue it. You know, I think there are other contexts where folks will wait to see how things break out, you know, whether other lawyers come on board. But, you know, I felt pretty good about it. I mean, I felt like, you know, the one thing I was sure of was that no one was going to know the case better than me going into the oral argument. And so everything else was just about, like, getting over the awkwardness of being a first-time advocate.
And what did you do to prepare, given that this is a new sort of role for you? I'm envisioning a kind of Rocky, like, training montage of a sort of moot court sessions and other sorts of exercises. What were the steps that you took to get ready and to feel comfortable in this role?
Yeah, I mean, I ran up the stairs of the Philadelphia Art Museum a couple hundred times. So, you know, the best thing you can do is practice. And so I was really lucky to have, you know, friends and colleagues who took the time to do a bunch of moots with me. I think in all I ended up doing 6 moot arguments for the, you know, in preparation for the big day. You know, you do the moots, you sort of sit down with your co-counsel and you just, you know, brainstorm questions that could come up and strategize about how to answer them. I think, honestly, the hardest thing for me was not, you know, sort of figuring out what the answers were to each question, but there's a professorial instinct to answer a question all the way to the bottom. And if it takes 7 minutes to get through the 6 different reasons why the answer is thus, you know, you do it. And you can't do that in oral argument. I mean, in oral argument, you really have to triage. And so, you know, one of the real tricks for me was not just getting all of the answers on the table, but was trying to figure out, you know, which were the answers to lead with in a context in which you knew that you were going to have a very short period of time to cover a case with a remarkable number of different questions. And so I think that was, you know, for preparation, that was the hardest thing for me, was reducing the number of things I wanted to say in response to each question.
Absolutely. And in the lead up to kind of the day of the actual argument, you know, did you sit through the prior argument before your case and watch that? Or were you in back kind of just getting ready to enter on the big field and prepare? What was the actual process like the day of?
So I was actually really happy to sit in the courtroom. You know, if you're arguing the second case of the day, there's a backup counsel table that's just behind the arguing counsel's table. And so it's actually one of the best seats in the house. And actually, I was really, really glad that I was able to, you know, have an hour, basically, after the pomp and circumstance of the court coming into session, the justices ascending the bench, to just sort of, you know, collect my thoughts, to watch other people argue, and to settle into the moment. I think it would have been a lot more stressful for me if I had been first. And it was really fun to sit there. I mean, the first case was this hyper-technical civil procedure case where my, you know, former mentor Neil Katyal was arguing on behalf of the respondents. And it was just a lot of fun to see Neil in action and to sort of, you know, rev myself up for what I was about to do. Basically, like, you know, look, they get questions they're not sure of the answer of either, right? And the justices, you know, they're human. They're smiling. They're having a good time. Like, this is not as intimidating as it might feel like at first blush.
And coming in, you know, in your oral arguments, you got, as I mentioned before, you got some pretty strong pushback from some of the justices early on. We mentioned Justice Ginsburg's pushback on kind of the remedies angle. What did you find to be the hardest line of questioning that you encountered? And was it something that caught you off guard or unexpectedly, or simply just a hard point to get across in the context?
So, I mean, I think, you know, Justice Alito, I think, seized on one of the hardest questions for us on the remedy, which is the fact that Congress in 1983 had taken out of the statute the language that automatically required the officer's termination. We actually have, I think, a pretty good answer to why that doesn't change things in our cases, at least. But, you know, again, it was about trying to get that answer out in the format that you were presented, like to get that answer out really quickly. And I tried to sort of put the 1983 amendments in context, which of course led Justice Gorsuch to push me on where my text was, since the argument actually is about stuff that's not in the text of the statute. So that was, I think, the most substantively challenging. But frankly, I mean, Scott, it was also stuff that we were ready for. I mean, we knew that was going to be one of the pressure points. I think the weirdest, you know, the thing that caught me the most off guard was the most reported tidbit from the argument, which was when Justice Kennedy asked me if I thought Marbury was rightly decided. that was, I think, the one question I got in the whole argument session that I just wasn't prepared for at all. And, you know, I think everyone had a good time with it, I think, including me.
That's good. And what was your response to that, out of curiosity? And for non-lawyers listening, Marbury versus Madison is the first case you learn in law school, and arguably the fundamental case underlying the whole process of judicial review that we spend all of law school and our legal careers learning about. So what was your answer to that? It's not an easy question necessarily.
I mean, first, I think it's worth stressing that in Justice Kennedy's defense, he was not asking if the part of Marbury that upheld the Supreme Court's power to invalidate acts of Congress was rightly decided. I think he takes that as a given. Otherwise, he'd be out of work. He was asking a much more nerdy question about how Chief Justice Marshall applies the power of judicial review in Marbury to interpret Article 3 of the Constitution to not allow Congress to expand the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. And what I said in response, after sort of not really thinking that he was serious, I mean, you can't tell from the transcript, but you know, while everyone in the courtroom was laughing at the question, I was looking at Justice Kennedy somewhat quizzically, like, are you really asking me this question right now? And he basically, in his body language, made clear that he was, that it was not a rhetorical question, that he wanted me to answer. And what I said was that, you know, I'm one of those who thinks that Chief Justice Marshall went out of his way in Marbury to read the statute, Section 13 of the Judiciary Act of 1789, and the relevant text of Article 3 to reach the constitutional question and to reach the result he wanted to reach. I'm not sure he reached the wrong result, but I certainly think it was avoidable and perhaps ought to have been avoided in a different context. So, you know, that was my sort of a little bit for everybody answer, which I might have tweaked it a bit if I had to do it again, but I think on the spot, you know, I'll take it.
That's pretty good to me. It sounds a lot better than I think I would have been able to pull off. How did you think your line of questioning went compared to the government and to Professor Bomzai? Did you feel like you got a lot more scrutiny to your arguments? Did you feel that the government was also pushed equally hard? And is there anything that, as somebody who watches Supreme Court cases a lot, that you think can be taken away from that?
So, I mean, I think it's my attitude changed a lot over the course of the hour. You know, I went first, and I think I presented for a little bit over 25 minutes before I reserved my time for rebuttal. And I think when I sat down the first time, I felt pretty good. I had gotten pushed pretty hard, but I actually thought I'd held up pretty well. You know, I had sort of handled, I think, Justice Kennedy's Marbury question. And so at least at that point, I was like, hey, you know, that was not an epic disaster. And then the next sort of 25 minutes or so were first Aditya and then Brian Fletcher, the assistant to the Solicitor General who argued for the government, talking only about the Article III jurisdictional question, which, you know, I'm interested in, but which I sort of didn't really cut one way or the other on the merits of the case. Right. It was when Brian Fletcher finally turned to the merits that I think it became pretty clear where the justices were, which is to say, on his side. So, you know, Brian basically got to speak for 10 to 15 virtually uninterrupted minutes about the merits, where the only question he got as he walked through each prong of the government's merits position was a clarifying question from the Chief Justice that, you know, could probably be paraphrased as, you know, does it matter which way we rule for you? And so given that that was literally the only question he got, you know, by the time I stood up for rebuttal, it seemed pretty clear to me that we were losing, and we were losing pretty big. And so, you know, at that point, all you can do is you can't relitigate the whole case in rebuttal. You can just try to sort of add a couple of reasons why the court may not want to, you know, just sort of jump on the government side. But I felt pretty confident walking out of the courtroom on Tuesday, and I think only as confident today that, you know, this is not going to end well for me and my clients.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but, you know, at least, you know, it sounds like you were able to put forward the arguments that you wanted, which is good. And I will say, while you may not have thought the court was in your favor, certainly the courtroom artist, I think, was a strong backer of yours. As you made out looking, I think you compared yourself to John Hamm in your own National Security Law podcast at some point, whereas poor Brian Fletcher, I think, had a more of a Supreme Leader Snoke kind of treatment, which was not entirely fair to him by any means. But,
Whereas the John Hamm treatment is ridiculously fair, which is to say, like, you know, too fair to me.
Exact. Fair, impartial, and just on all measures, I'm sure. So you closed your oral arguments in your rebuttal, presumably deliberately, because you saved yourself a chunk of time to do this in, with a strong point about the relevance of this case to the broader question of the military commissions. And you alluded to that a little bit earlier, but I wanted to give you a chance to kind of bring that point in, because I think it's an important one for Lawfare readers and listeners that will really resonate with them.
Sure. I mean, so there are two ways to look at the you know, there are two ways we could lose this case, assuming the court doesn't, you know, say it has no jurisdiction over the Court of Appeals. The first way is the court says that there's just no violation of the dual office holding ban at all, in which case, of course, the defendants in the military commissions won't have any easier of a road trying to make this argument in the military commissions or in the CMCR. But there's also the possibility that the court sides with the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. In its ruling in the Ortiz case, what the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces said was there's no remedy that redounds to the court-martial system, but that doesn't mean that there's no remedy in the military commission system. And what the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces was implying was that it may very well be that the proper remedy for a violation of the dual office holding ban today redounds to the second office, not the first, and that, in fact, these judges, therefore, should not have been eligible to be appointed to the CMCR at all and are ineligible to continue serving on the CMCR. That would be a big deal because it would not only call into question, you know, a number of rulings that the CMCR has already issued, but there is a pending petition for writ of mandamus in the D.C. Circuit in the 9/11 case from the CMCR where two of the defendants in the 9/11 military commission trial are making these exact objections to the service of two of the military officer judges on the Court of Military Commission Review. We argued all along that if we were right, then that claim would go away because on our reading, the appointments to the CMCR were valid. They just happened to convert those appointees into civilians. But as civilians, they were perfectly eligible to sit on the CMCR and to resolve these cases. If the Supreme Court sides with the government on the remedy point and either doesn't reach the merits of the dual office holding violation or agrees with us that there was a violation, that's just going to open the door to the D.C. Circuit having to really reach the merits of the pending petition in the 9/11 case, which they've been holding in abeyance, you know, since shortly after the court granted cert. So, you know, I tried to suggest at the very end of the argument that ruling for the government is not as easy as the court might think. Because not only would it potentially open the door to have to fight this issue out in the context of the 9/11 trial, but it would also raise a serious commander-in-chief clause concern with the CMCR insofar as you could have these active duty military officers serving in positions that come with good cause removal protection and that would therefore take them out of the chain of command. You know, we made this argument in our briefs. I thought it was a pretty good one, but again, you know, when the government argued to the contrary in the Supreme Court, none of the justices pushed back. So I just don't know if we got any traction there.
Absolutely. And it sounds like a ruling in that direction along the lines of the CAF lines would be a major setback to our military commission system that's already drawn on for so long.
Well, and that's the question. So I think the question is, like, you know, to what extent is or should it be on the justices' radar that if they just adopt the logic of Ortiz, they may not be doing the military commissions any favors, whereas our position would actually, you know, tie things together rather neatly and avoid the constitutional problems that we think would otherwise arise. You know, I had thought that was a pretty compelling argument, but, you know, Scott, frankly, there were a lot of things I thought were pretty compelling arguments until I stood up there and saw how they resonated, or more importantly, how they didn't.
Fair. Well, now it sounds like you've got at least a couple months to sit back and wait anxiously for the results of the oral argument. What do you do in the interim, in the meantime? You're just sitting on your hands, essentially?
You know, I go back to my day job. I mean, this was all basically extracurricular for me. This is, you know, my full-time, I get paid a perfectly handsome salary to be a full-time law professor. And so, you know, teaching my classes, you know, doing my sort of scholarship, blogging for Lawfare and Just Security, these are, you know, the things I really ought to be doing with my time as opposed to, you know, little detours to the Supreme Court. So I probably won't just be sitting on my hands. You know, there's plenty of work to be done. We seem to be living in a very active time in the world of national security law and policy. But, you know, I do think that even if we lose this case, I'm really glad to have brought so much attention to the statute, which I think is you know, a quietly important piece of this larger puzzle about civilian control of the military that really I think folks don't know a lot about, even though it's doing a lot of work on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And in the worst case scenario, you know, you've had a direct hand in what is going to be an important decision on issues ranging from the military commission, Supreme Court's jurisdiction that, you know, law students, whether they're your students or other people's students, will be studying for a long time to come. So you should be able to take some pride in that, certainly.
Well, listen, and I can take pride in knowing that, you know, I can only lose 9-0. You know, the good news is that I can't lose 10-0.
Fair. Yeah, there's a silver lining to everything. Well, Steve Vladeck, thank you so much for joining us today on the Lawfare Podcast. This has been a really enlightening conversation, and hopefully we can touch base again once we get a decision.
I'd love it. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, force it on your friends, loved ones, and coworkers, or just give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. As always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thank you for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.